I'm Najaswat for BizNews.com, and I'm joined by Dr. David Wiseman, a research bioscientist with background in pharmacy, pharmacology, immunology, and experimental pathology. Dr. Wiseman, thank you so much for your time.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Fantastic.
Dr. Wiseman, just by way of introduction, can you give me a brief intro for your background and what made you turn your attention to COVID-19?
So you mentioned my sort of overall areas at the beginning there. I had headed up a research program at Johnson & Johnson involved in medical product development, and I was one of the top scientists at J&J. I started my own R&D company 26 years ago, and so we've been helping many companies, big and small, develop medical products. So we have a very good understanding of what it takes to develop a medical product, what has to happen to go through the regulatory approvals, different kinds of animal studies, human studies, safety studies, and so on and so forth. In addition to that, when COVID started 2.5, nearly 3 years ago, I guess, everyone was asking, what can we do? You know, what can we do to help? And so I started looking at it and say, well, what skills and knowledge do I have that might be relevant? And so it turns out a lot, because of the pathology of COVID, there's a lot of stuff that I knew from all of my other experience that I felt would be applicable. So I started to learn and understand and read and so on and so forth. I started looking at some of the studies with the drugs, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which I wasn't very enthusiastic about at first, frankly. I thought the evidence was weak. But after looking at some studies in very, very great detail, looking at the raw data, getting additional data from the authors, I found that some of the main studies that were used to support public policy for hydroxychloroquine were in fact severely flawed. And so that really got me into the whole COVID story much more deeply. And one thing led to another, started looking at vaccines and started getting involved with other people and saying, well, there's a really big problem here, how this pandemic is being managed. So I started looking at FDA, CDC, what regulatory things were going on there. And it resulted in now over 20-something submissions that I've made along with colleagues to FDA or CDC meetings that have happened in the last year or so.
It brings me to my next question. At the beginning of this month, September, you wrote a paper about the FDA's ever-relaxing standards in that they've now authorized emergency usage authorization for the BA4/5 bivalent quasi-vaccine. So before we get into the paper, can you just briefly explain the different elements of this concept?
Okay, so as you probably know, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, which are the predominant vaccines, at least in the United States and many parts of the world, there are other vaccines as well. Those vaccines were designed originally against the original Wuhan strain of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is, again, nearly 3 years old, I guess, now. And as you know, the virus has mutated significantly in various mutations, at least in the United States. We had the Alpha and the Delta and then the Omicron. There were other variants in different parts of the world. And the virus has mutated so much that the vaccine as designed is really not relevant any longer. And we have, in many studies, negative efficacy, meaning that the original vaccines actually, at certain points of time, place someone at greater risk of getting COVID than if they had not received the vaccine. So recognizing all of these things, many months ago, Pfizer and Moderna started to redesign their vaccines to address the Omicron variant back at the beginning of 2022. By the time they'd done some preliminary clinical studies in June, that vaccine, which was directed against the BA1 version of the Omicron, had now become obsolete, although it has been authorized in some countries. And so they really can't make the vaccine, they can't modify the vaccine quickly enough to catch up with the rate of mutation. And so based on that, the FDA relaxed their standards even further to say, okay, we will accept, instead of clinical data, we'll accept, even though we'll take clinical data for the vaccines that have happened until now, but in terms of the new variant version of vaccines, we'll take data that's not clinical. for example, animal data. And so the Pfizer and Moderna have designed BA4/5 versions of their vaccines, which now the FDA has authorized. Now, to understand what BA4/5 means, there is a BA4 variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. There's a BA5 variant, but because the spike protein, that thing that sticks up that everyone's seen the pictures of, is said to be identical in the BA4 and the BA5 variants. They differ in other ways, but in terms of the spike protein to which the vaccines are directed, the BA4 and the BA5 are said to be identical. So that's why it's called BA4/5. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then to make it even more complicated, the vaccines are mixed. There's the mRNA, the messenger RNA, which causes your body to produce the BA4/5 type spike protein. But it also has the messenger RNA from the original version of the vaccine, which causes it to make the spike protein version of the original vaccine. So because of that, the vaccines are said to be bivalent.
If the reason for making these new boosters is waning efficacy of the original vaccines, then why create something that still has an effect on the Wuhan strain?
There's a difference between the word waning efficacy and, I'll call it, escape immunity, if that's the right word. So waning means that even if you have the same variant still around, the immunity against that has waned across time. That's one problem. The second problem is that if the variant changes, then the vaccine that was made to the original variant may not be active against the new variant. That's a different concept from waning. So you have waning, where it naturally declines, and then escape, meaning it's no longer relevant to the new variant. So your question is, why did they mix the two together? And the reason was based on a meeting that happened in June at the FDA, where Pfizer and Moderna presented data that they had accumulated independently with BA1 versions of the new Omicron vaccine. And they had versions that were just BA1. We'll call that monovalent, mono one, valent one type. Okay. And they had versions that were bivalent, meaning they had BA1 mixed with Wuhan. And the data were not clear, but the general consensus, at least from certain types of antibody measurements they took, which that's a whole nother problem as to how relevant they are, but we'll go with that for a moment. Based on certain antibody measurements they took, it seemed, at least from the Moderna data, that the bivalent was going to provide broader protection, and there would be still protection that would linger, as it were, against the BA.5/4.5, which was up and coming back in June. Now it's just reached its peak in the United States, and now it's starting to decline. So the feeling was that by having sort of the old and the new, as it were, it would give a broader protection. And the fear that the FDA had expressed, and other people have expressed, is that we may, quote unquote, get a wave of COVID in the fall, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. Springtime for you guys. All right. Based on modeling, and the modeling has not been validated. There was a question specifically asked about that. Based on basically mathematical, statistical modeling, they felt there was going to be some kind of wave that was going to happen in the fall. So we want to have the broadest coverage possible that we can design based on everything that we know until now. Okay, that whatever comes to hit us, we've got some chance, we're hedging our bets, we've got some chance that whatever vaccine we're going to produce has at least some efficacy against whatever may happen in the autumn time. So that was the feeling why they went to a bivalent as to a monovalent, although it's not entirely clear, but there was at least some wisdom to that. It's not an unreasonable thing, but there are potential problems with that, in as much as you have something called antibody-dependent enhancement. And so if you produce antibodies that are so weak, as it were, against the virus, those actually may enhance the ability to acquire infection. So it's not just we might as well do it kind of, you know, scenario. There is a potential downside, which has not been really fully explored.
Why, if the world is no longer in a pandemic state of emergency, is the FDA still authorizing emergency usage vaccines and boosters?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. So I'm sure every country in the world has different laws that deal with some kind of emergency scenario that permits their medical regulatory authority to to sort of authorize on a temporary emergency basis products that would normally take much longer and much more scrutiny to review. And so by prolonging that state of emergency or allowing it to continue in the way that I'm not sure if any country has declared it not an emergency anymore. Maybe there is, but I'm not aware. But it allows the maintenance of this sort of relaxed set of requirements that continue. So, you know, politically, we can come up with all sorts of, reasons, and I'm not going to go into that. But and everyone's got their theory about that. But at least procedurally, it allows them to sort of keep going as we've been doing for 2 years, 2.5 years, and to employ relaxed standards.
What are the FDA standards? Because having been one of the 66 top scientists at Johnson & Johnson, you are intimate with the processes of getting a new product to market. How do you think that companies like J&J, Pfizer, Moderna have gotten their vaccines to market with what we would like to believe are very strong protective hurdles?
Right. I would say there are two areas where we can talk about relaxed standards. There's the sort of legally permitted areas of relaxation, and there's the ones that are, I think, that have gone even way beyond that. So in terms of, let's agree that there was an emergency that existed. We all were looking at the graphs and, you know, the numbers were going up and up and up. And, you know, without going into whether that was true or not, I know there are people that, you know, really challenge that. But there's obviously a real concern that we have to do something very quickly. And so it's not unreasonable for governments to have, for laws to exist to allow relaxed standards. So the legally relaxed standard, as it were, in the United States, is that normally a medical product has to pass certain thresholds of safety and efficacy. The FDA has to satisfy itself that the product is safe and efficacious. And they have a whole series of guidelines as to what exactly that means. Okay, what kind of studies you do and how long it takes and how many patients and that type of thing. Okay, now under the emergency use authorization provisions, the effective standard, the word effective, that's a technical term, the effective standard is relaxed to a maybe effective standard. That's the word that appears in the regulations or the guidelines, that the FDA doesn't have to satisfy itself that the product is effective. It just has to have reasonable belief that it may be effective. So that's a lower level of standard. Okay. Now, in terms of safety, again, you know, these are moving targets always, but there's sort of a general idea of what safety means. But in terms of the emergency use authorizations, they don't have to show it to be as safe as they would have done in a normal situation. They merely have to, they have to at least make an argument that the potential and known benefits outweigh the potential and known risks. That's a slightly different thing of way of saying that it's not the same as saying, you know, we've demonstrated safety. So those are the sort of what the statute provides. And I guess other countries have similar kinds of definitions. I don't know what they are in your country, but I'm sure they have similar types of definitions. Okay. What's now happened is that those definitions of what exactly may be effective is, I mean, how low is may be effective? So it may be effective, the FDA defined as the vaccine has to have 50% efficacy with a lower confidence interval of 30%. That's a measure of margin of error. Okay. But now that standard's gone lower and lower and lower and lower, as we've seen in the children's vaccination authorizations in June. Well, now we have mice and other studies being used to support these BA.4/5 vaccines.
It stands out to me that these standards have been getting lower and lower and lower as the level of risk has been decreasing significantly as well. What do you think is behind the push towards continued mass vaccination if the world is perhaps still by certain standards or regulations in pandemic mode, but not at significant risk as we perhaps once were?
You know, I think a certain mindset has developed, and you know, there are many people who have all sorts of theories on this, but I think just very practically, a mindset has developed among regulators that this is the way to go. That they were stuck in this paradigm 2 years ago. Vaccine, that's the way to go, and we're not going to consider anything else. Not repurposed drugs, other measures that they could have taken to improve health, address underlying comorbidities, all sorts of things. And this is their mode, and it's become politicized as well. So it was politicized, you know, in the United States of America in 2020 when there was an election. And we have now midterm elections coming up. So there's a politicization. And to the point that in the modeling, in this meeting that took place in September, but there was one little slide, which I think was a real telltale slide, frankly. And what had happened in the modeling, the statistical modeling of what this supposed wave is going to do and when it's going to hit and how many people are going to die, they had some calculations back in June. Now, that in the calculations, the updated versions of those calculations were that, well, if we start vaccinating in November, then so many people are going to die. But if we started vaccinating in September, fewer people are going to die. Well, that was never talked about in June. They knew how long it was going to take to develop these quasi-vaccines. They knew the timetables. Okay, so there was nothing. There was no new information that they had in September that they didn't already have in June. But there's one new piece of thing, and that is in November in the United States we have midterm elections. So I can't tell you that that's a factor, but to me, you know, it's awfully suspicious. And I think the politicization of this whole pandemic has been one of the big downfalls as to why we're in this complete mess worldwide.
In one of your papers, you referred to immunological addiction. So the time periods between the recommendations to get a booster are becoming increasingly shorter. What is immunological addiction and what are its implications?
Well, I use that term. I'm not sure if it's an official term, but back in nearly a year ago, I think I gave an interview to somewhere where I talked about the using boosters to get out of this is the immunological equivalent of heroin addiction. I mean, I was trying to come up with a sort of terminology that encapsulated lots of things. This is a very complicated field, but what we're seeing is that originally when the boosters were authorized about a year ago, they were authorized with an interval of about 6 months from the time when the primary series had been given, which was, you know, a 3 or 4 week interval typically. Okay, that 6 month interval has gone down to 5 months, and now what FDA did, they slipped in under the carpet, which was never discussed at all at previous FDA meetings. They slipped under the carpet that these new variant boosters could be given as short an interval as 2 months. And the reason, even though the FDA, when asked about this, said, well, this is only going to apply to a few people. Most people, the interval is going to be 5 or 6 months. You know, they sort of brushed it off. But that is not a trivial thing. Even the members of the CDC committee said, what's going on here? We're not comfortable about this. And they were given very evasive, obfuscating answers. But the problem is, I think the head of the EMA, one of the senior officials of the EMA, Dr. Cavallari, I'm not sure I'm saying his name correctly, back in January made a statement that, you know, to boost very, very frequently could compromise the ability of the immune system to do what we want it to do. So the basic premise is that the efficacy is waning, and if we boost, then we can sort of get it back again. But you can only flog a dead horse so many times. And so you run the risk of getting less and less benefit with more and more risk because you're giving more vaccine doses. Each of them comes with its own risks. And we're trying to boost ourselves out of this situation. Dr. Sarah Long, who is one of the leading pediatric infectious disease doctors, who was on the CDC advisory committee back in January, I think it was, when they were authorizing the 12 to 15-year-old boosting doses, I think it was. She said at the time, she said, we can't do this. We can't keep boosting. This is the last whack-a-mole. You know, the game, you know, familiar with that.
Yeah.
This is the last whack-a-mole. So no one seriously thinks this is a good idea. And yet the FDA slipped in that you could get it to 2 months. The reason why it's 2 months is because even in the CDC figures, by 3 months in the CDC figures, the efficacy of these quasi-vaccines is basically statistically indistinguishable from zero. So they probably wanted to get it in there on the books without having to go through a committee and be under the scrutiny of the VRBPAC, the advisory committee that advises the FDA.
Dr. Wiseman, just to close off with, can you, in layman's terms, explain to me what a gene-based therapy is? Because these vaccines are said to be gene-based therapies.
Well, I mean, they are. There's no question. So gene therapies, there's a broad category. But any time you're delivering nucleic acids into the cell, okay, a nucleic acid is ribonucleic acid. That's RNA. Everyone's familiar with that term. They don't know what the words mean. Or deoxyribonucleic acid, that's DNA. Everyone's heard that term. Okay, these are nucleic acids. These are your genes or very close relations of the genes. And when, by delivering these things into the body, you're instructing the body. The body is being hijacked to produce something that it would not normally produce. So just imagine you have Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants in South Africa. Imagine the Kentucky Fried Chicken guys take their recipe and they walk into a McDonald's restaurant, okay? And they go into the kitchen of the McDonald's restaurant and they say, okay, here's the recipe. And all of a sudden, the McDonald's restaurant starts making Kentucky Fried Chicken, okay? So that's what a gene therapy is, because a gene therapy is taking instructions that you don't normally have. McDonald's don't normally have the instructions for Kentucky Fried Chicken. But Kentucky Fried Chicken are able to walk into the McDonald's restaurant, give their instructions, their recipe for making their Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, meal, and give it to the kitchen of the McDonald's restaurant, and then they're starting to produce Kentucky Fried Chicken. That's exactly what gene therapy is. We're taking instructions that we don't normally process, and we're hijacking the kitchen of our bodies, as it were, to produce things that are not normally there. Now, this is a very exciting technology that has tremendous potential, but it's got to be done right. And because there's so many things, this is such highly complicated stuff. There's all sorts of stuff that we don't know. We're only beginning to learn what the consequences are when you walk into a McDonald's restaurant with a Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, recipe. There's many things that can happen, and that's why so much scrutiny is really needed in this particular case. And the case in point, in you asked earlier about, well, why is the bivalent vaccines working better than the monovalent vaccines? Well, at least according to Moderna, we don't know how it works in the Pfizer, but at least according to Moderna, they let slip the following. They said that they have, I'll say, two recipes, as it were. So you have a Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe, and you have a Wendy's recipe, and that's the equivalent of our Omicron BA5 and our Wuhan, okay? Mm-hmm. And you put that into one package with these lipid nanoparticles, and you send that into the McDonald's restaurant. And now the McDonald's restaurant isn't just producing, you know, Wendy's, and it isn't mm-hmm. just producing Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's producing both. So that's bivalent. But here's the thing. Because you put them in the same package, what Moderna is saying is that you can actually have opportunity for crossover. So not only would the restaurant now produce your Wendy's and your Kentucky Fried Chicken, but it's going to produce a Wendy's that's got a little bit of Kentucky Fried Chicken in it, and it's going to produce a Kentucky Fried Chicken that's got a little bit of Wendy's in it. So now you've got four sort of different meals, as it were, that are being produced. Moderna is saying that the way that they have designed their bivalent, you know, BA4/5 plus Omicron, is that the way they think it works is that when these two recipes get into the cell, they not only produce the Wuhan type of spike protein, they not only produce the Omicron BA4 type of spike protein, but they're also producing two types of spike proteins that have different mixtures of the two. So you've got four types of spike proteins. So in that sense, it's not even really bivalent. It's really, in a sense, tetravalent or quadrivalent. It's producing four types of spike proteins. Okay, and that's what they're saying. They're saying, well, the reason we think why we've got a much broader immunity because of certain features that cause it. Well, that's new pharmacology, and then that's huge. That's huge. Okay, if it's not bad enough before, now we've got four things that are going on, and that's new toxicology. That's new pharmacology that they can't ignore.
Surely, with the introduction to the market of a product as novel as mRNA technology, the standards have to be more strict. There has to be some sort of pharmacovigilance at play. This is serious stuff.
It's very serious stuff. So, in fact, I haven't read it yet, but I think that Denmark have now restricted these boosters to only 50 years old. I think in the UK, they're restricted. They're using the BA1. I think below 12, they're not allowing it at this point. I'm not sure. But in terms of the pharmacovigilance, you know, one of the things that I've done in collaboration with others is to look at the safety signals in the VAERS system, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. We all know there's, you know, it's got limitations for lots of reasons that everyone knows about. But we did the analyses that the CDC said they were going to be doing, called something called a PRR analysis. It doesn't matter what it really means. But we actually did those analyses back over a year ago. And we found signals. Now, a signal doesn't prove that the drug did it, but it's a signal to say we better look into this. Okay. So we saw signals using the methodology that CDC had said they were going to do. The methodology isn't very good, actually. There's actually better methodology that we use. And so, of course, we saw the signals with that. Okay, but you've probably seen the reports that one of my collaborators, Dr. Getzko from Hebrew University, he filed a Freedom of Information request a number of months ago and asked the CDC, well, where are your PRR analyses? And they said, well, we didn't do them. And then there was backwards and forwards. And they said, no, yes, we did. And no, we didn't. And I'm not actually sure where it is at this moment. But that's actually not as bad as that is. As bad as that is, what people don't realize is that there were studies being funded by NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is a different part of the United States government, biggest medical research institution in the world, probably. And they published papers several months ago where they did these type of analyses. Okay. Well, how come the NIH was doing them and the CDC wasn't doing them? Not only that, there's another paper that just came out about 2 weeks ago. First author is Harpaz, H-A-R-P-A-Z, where they said, well, there's problems with these analyses for certain reasons, but we think there's some signals here. And they looked at two things, tinnitus and I think it was embolism, I think it was the other one. So they're all saying there's problems with the VAERS, but they're not offering the answers. The answer is very simple. You don't have to do it that PRR method. The PRR method is not a very good, it's okay, but it's not very good. We've done the better method. We've given that to CDC. We've given that to the FDA over a year ago, okay? And nothing. I mean, this is just so alarming. You know, I can't begin to express that.
Dr. Wiseman, thank you so much for your time today. I'm Najaswat for Biznews.com.
Thank you.